Hello, my name is Andy Bombeck, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to continue reading articles from the June 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to finish the article that I started last week about New York Dolls frontman David Johansen, and then an article about Smokey Robinson and his album, A Quiet Storm, and then the classic album review of The Story by Brandi Carlile. I begin with the article that I started last week about David Johansen, who passed away this year, 1950 to 1925, titled The King of New York, Stack-Heeled Provocateur and Obsessive Blues Scholar, Rock and Roll Puritan and Punk Revolutionary, a Manhattan institution in a city cleaning itself up around him. David Johansen lived many lives in his hometown, all in pursuit of the best possible time. Chris Needs talks to his adoring fellow travelers and remembers encounters with the New York Doll stretching back over 50 years. I had this gift to incite a riot. And here's where I left off last week. The Mercer Residency found the New York Dolls at their most clear-eyed before drugs and addiction got the better of Johansen's bandmates. David was a drinker. His party drug was alcohol, says Sousa Coleman. I never saw him doing any chemicals. He was always just drinking and partying. By the end of 1972, Billy McCura had died following an overdose during a short tour of England. Regrouping with new drummer Jerry Nolan, the Dolls recorded two albums of proto-punk brilliance that, nevertheless, failed to break in the U.S. outside of the major cities. In late 1974, Malcolm McLaren arrived on the scene with a plan to revitalize the ailing band. According to Johansen, however, he was never their manager. Sly and I wrote a song called Red Patent Leather, Johansen explained in 2006. So we asked Malcolm to make us some red patent leather trousers. He was never our manager. He was our haberdasher. McLaren and Vivian Westwood duly created outfits for each doll. But it was Johansen's idea to have a communist red flag festooning the stage when the original band played their final New York shows at the Little Hippodrome in February 1975. We said, let's have a communist party. We made this flag and Malcolm had the pants. Malcolm said, oh yeah, I turned the Dolls into communist. Total bullshit. We just thought it was funny, but it became this big scandal. Johansen once drunkenly suggested that anyone in the New York Dolls could be replaced, and during a spring 1975 tour of Florida, Thunders and Nolan took him at his word and headed back to New York for heroin. Sylvian was enlisted to drive them to the airport. Kane soon followed them out of the band, but Johansen and Sylvian kept the Dolls running until the end of 1976. In 5 years' time, that album's going to be considered a classic, Johansen had declared when the first Dolls album met with disinterest in 1973. He later described it as Alan Lomax-style urban folk rock, folk art. In fact, it was considered a classic somewhat faster. By the time the New York Dolls finally broke up, they were being hailed as a key influence on New York's next big cultural movement. As punk took over the city, Johansson embarked on a solo career at odds with his past, releasing four albums of glossier, if still idiosyncratic, mainstream rock. Albums that nevertheless yielded classics like Frenchette and Heart of Gold. And here's a little bit of that song, Frenchette, by David Johansson. Sylvian still contributed, but Johansson's collaborators were now the likes of Mick Ronson and Blondie Chaplin, and his new role involved dismissing the whole costume thing as a late teens, early 20s kind of trip. Although he hung out at CBGB, David never got into the punk scene, says Sisu Coleman. He seemed to be more businesslike, whether it was acting or music. For decades, he remained a familiar figure on the streets of his beloved Manhattan, always immaculately dressed and carrying himself like the King of New York. Binky Phillips, whose band The Planets opened for the Dolls at the Mercer, remembers a day in spring 1981. Walking on 15th Street when David comes around the corner, all in white, with a transistor radio against his right ear. He sees me, he holds out the radio, it's Bob Marley's funeral. Binky, listen. Just dazzled and stoned. All I heard was static, with some muffled music way in the background. With David, you never knew where you were going to run into him or what was going to happen, says Sisu Coleman. Life was spontaneous with him. You didn't plan it. It just happened. Johansson released his last conventional solo album, Sweet Revenge, in 1984, but by then he'd embraced his new next major role. Earlier in the year, he had playfully launched a new character, Buster Poindexter, over four Monday nights at his favorite bar, Tramps. Poindexter was a pompadoued, rambunctiously sousaled crooner in a tux, singing jump blues and American songbook classics with the Banshees of Blue. While Johansson pursued a parallel career as an actor, Poindexter occupied him for the next 15 years, producing four albums and, finally, an actual U.S. hit in 1987 with his cover of the soca anthem, Hot, Hot, Hot. A little bit of that song, Hot, 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 by Buster Poindexter, or David Johansson. Fire. He started doing the Buster thing for fun, and then it caught on, says Lenny Kay. It was a way for him to be somebody different, get rid of the doll's baggage, even get rid of the David Johansen baggage, and assume a persona that you could have a good time with. When it started attracting people who came to see him, I think he was surprised, but he went with it. The blues, though, remained a constant to the fore on two albums he made fronting the Harry Smiths, recorded in New York churches at the turn of the century. His voice marinated by life, he poured his soul into the songs he'd loved as a teenager by Lightnin' Hopkins, Mississippi John Hurt, even Sonny Boy Williamson's Don't Start Me Talkin'. And here's a little bit of Don't Start Me Talkin' by the New York Dolls.
Going down a road, gonna talk to Fannie Mae. I gotta tell her what I heard. A boy been sick, but don't you stop me talking, or I'll tell everything I know. I'm bringing this thing to mind because somebody's got to go. Jack is like $2, wanna get some margin, but you step down on the street, you know. Oh, George stops a person. Can knock her down and gonna blacken her eyes. So when she gets back home, tell the husband a lie. Don't stop me talking, 'cause I'll tell everything I know. I'm bringing this thing to five because somebody got to go. Come on, let's get on.
Then came the reunion. Johansen hadn't spoken to Sylvian or Kane for over a decade. Thunders died in 1991 and Nolan in 1992. When the Dolls reunited for London's Meltdown Festival, curated by superfan Morrissey in 2004. "We were just going to do one show," Johansen told Mojo. "Then one show turned into two shows. Then Sly and I said, let's keep doing this as long as we're having fun." It happened very organically. Arthur Kane had died weeks after the 2004 gig from leukemia, but three albums followed, beginning with 2006's One Day It Will Please Us to Remember Even This. And history arcly repeated itself with Acclaim failing to translate into major sales. After 2011's Dancing Backwards in High Heels, the New York Dolls dissolved again, this time on their own terms, closure achieved. Sylvian was the penultimate doll to pass, the band's eternal cheerleader succumbing to cancer in January 2021. When Mojo spoke to Johansen about his fallen friend, however, the singer was keeping his own recent diagnosis under wraps, a secret he would protect for the next 4 years. 3 weeks before he passed away, on February the 28th, it was announced that Johansen had stage 4 cancer and a brain tumor. His wife, Mara Hennessy, and stepdaughter Leah appealed for financial assistance. Breaking his back in the fall of the previous November had left Johansen bedridden. It's a shame Sylvian didn't get to see how loved he was, Johansen told Mojo in 2021, deeply moved by the tributes to his old foil on social media. Johansen, though, would have seen the overwhelming response to his own care appeal, as in his final weeks, he finally dropped the roles he'd enjoyed playing all his life. "Now all the Dolls are gone," says Sisu Coleman, who helped facilitate the band's first major break. "When David left, it felt like the end of an era and closure to the whole Mercer scene." David was the one who stayed on track, creating new characters and doing new ventures. When he passed away, it was like, God, what's left? Johansson had that sense of otherness which characterized New York's East Village scene, says Lenny Kaye. The sense you were not part of normal society. He could step outside himself and see outrageousness and fun in everything. It's a great gift to understand your persona enough not to be taken in by it. He was always that kid from Staten Island, happy to be part of whoever he became. In later years, Johansson inhabited another role as a top-notch DJ, hosting the weekly Mansion of Fun radio show on Sirius XM. After recording a final episode, his widow, Mara, repaired to their favorite spot in the California desert. My experience of being with David for the past 25 years in love has been graced with countless transformative shows all over this world, she wrote. David was some kind of shaman frontman in every persona he set out to walk on stage. He lived a life in love with music, creating, performing, and listening. David and I were fans of the Portuguese writer Fernando Pessoa, who also famously created various persona through which to express different interpretations of what is art and what is life. Here's a line: music in the soul can be heard by the universe. Today, I watch the sun rise over the desert. Later, I will watch it set with David. Okay, now I move on to the Smokey Robinson article titled Written on the Wind. In 1975, a songwriting genius mired in existential crisis, pushing pens in Motown's L.A. office, came out of early retirement with an album that invented a whole new genre of soul. 50 years on, Smokey Robinson approaches UK shores with a live show based around the languid intimacy of A Quiet Storm. I was like a prisoner in a cage of my own making, he tells Andrew Mail. Out on the road with the Miracles in 1971, Smokey Robinson had had enough. The plan had been to retire following the birth of his son, Barry, in 1968, and settle down with his wife, former Miracle Claudette. Boistered by his salary as the vice president of Motown Records and substantial royalties he'd received for penning or co-writing such landmarks, Hitsville smashes. Landmarks, moreover, in the very art of songwriting, as I Second That Emotion, My Girl, Get Ready, Ain't That Peculiar, and The Tracks of My Tears. And here's a little bit of that song, The Tracks of My Tears, by The Miracles. But the rest of the Miracles depended on that concert money and wanted their leader to stay on the road. It wasn't an easy decision. We'd grown up together, explains Robinson today. I'd known these guys since I was 10 years old. but I hated touring, hated it. He'd been singing professionally with Warren Pete Moore and Ronnie White since 1955, first in the Five Chimes, then as the Miracles, with the subsequent addition of Claudette and Bobby Rogers and Mary Tarplin. And since 1965, as Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, the elevation of Robinson's billing, giving some indication of the changing politics within the group. Add to that the birth of another child, Tamla, in 1971, and whispers in the Miracles camp that Robinson could be more generous with his residuals. And you can understand why the singer felt, in his own words, like a prisoner in a cage of my own making, still performing, still trying to act like my heart was in it. Eventually, a replacement singer, Billy Griffin, was found, and Robinson wrote the group a farewell song, Sweet Harmony. My intention, says Robinson, was to just make 5 copies and give each Miracle a copy, because Sweet Harmony was telling them, I'm no longer going to be with you, but you can do wonderful things without me. I had no intention of ever being back on stage or recording again. But then Suzanne DePass, the A&R director at Motown, listened to Sweet Harmony and told Robinson the world should hear this and know that you're not leaving because of something negative. So I finally acquiesced, says Robinson. Okay, fine. You can put it out for the world to hear. So she comes back to me the next day and says, but you know we're going to need an album. Watch the July 13th, 1973 edition of Midnight Special, in which Robinson sings Sweet Harmony before introducing the new Miracles lineup to perform the upbeat, disco-fied What Is a Heart Good For? And you see a group desperate to be seen as eager and vital. Some of that song, What Is a Heart Good For? By The Miracles. Their former frontman, also there to promote his solo debut, Smokey, appears more reserved, performing in a state of, well, it's hard to tell, ease, relief, denial, exhaustion. It was, I don't want this, you know, says Robinson. But then, after Sweet Harmony, radio starts to play this song I'd written with Mary Tarplin, Baby Come Close. Then it becomes a hit, and Suzanne comes to me and says, we need another album. But I'm out of show business, I said. I'm not recording anymore. But there it is. I did that. I made those 2 albums in my retirement. Robinson laughs at the irony of what he's just said. Then I made A Quiet Storm. It's the morning of January 21st in Los Angeles, California, and the skies are still an apocalyptic shade of orange in the wake of the huge fires that have raged over the country in the past 2 weeks. So far, thank God we're okay, says a bright-eyed Smokey Robinson in his white-walled L.A. studio. We've escaped the fires in my neighborhood, but they have been raging pretty close by, and a lot of my friends have had to evacuate. I have a nephew whose whole street was burned down. We'd planned to talk about A Quiet Storm, the rapturous 1975 solo masterpiece that will form the backbone of his forthcoming 2025 Legacy Tour. But the dark irony is not lost on him that the hot Santa Ana winds that informed the tender force of that album are the same gales that fueled the recent blazes. Right now, you don't want those storms, he says, laughing. If you were here now in Los Angeles, you don't talk about the wind. We're not having quiet storms, we're having hurricanes. But back in 1973, following a family move from Southfield, Michigan to Beverly Hills, Los Angeles, the Santa Ana winds were Smokey Robinson's muse. The restless, dry whine that soundtracked his daily commute to Motown's West Hollywood office and his nighttime drift through the clubs and bars of downtown L.A. I was vice president of Motown, explains Robinson. When I lived in Detroit, my job was to induct new talent. But when I moved out to Los Angeles, Motown boss Berry Gordy put me in charge of the financial office, signing all the company payroll checks. It was wonderful at first because I was at home with my kids and my wife, Claudette. Then it started to play on me. I found myself missing show business. I started to go to little clubs at night and watch the acts on stage, just so I could see somebody performing, you know? Anyone who's listened to Robinson's second solo LP, Pure Smokey, might have sensed something was wrong. I wasn't into it, Robinson has said. I was just doing what they wanted me to do. But despite the laid-back vibe, it was an emotionally heavy album. Beyond its somewhat controversial single, Virgin Man, about sexually inexperienced men who lie about their conquest, the themes were defiantly autobiographical. Its Her Turn to Live was dedicated to Robinson's elder sister, Geraldine, who helped raise him after his mother died. She's Only a Baby herself referenced the pregnancy of his own 16-year-old daughter, while The Love Between Me and My Kids was skipping upbeat groove about how divorced parents negotiate time with their children. I forgot those were real powerful songs, says Robinson today. I guess I was writing my emotions, but I didn't realize that, and even if that was the case, it was not my intention to come back to show business at all. But someone was listening. Well, says Robinson, one day Barry came to my office and said, "Hey, man, I want you to do something for me." I'm thinking he's going to tell me to do something corporate. Go have a meeting with somebody, go make a deal. I said, "What is it?" He said, "I need you to get a band, go in the studio and make a record. I need you to get the elf out of here." He said, "You're miserable, and I don't want to see you miserable, because when I see you miserable, it makes me miserable. So get out of my face." So I said, "Okay, fine," and I hugged him because I wanted to. On his way home, Robinson started to think about a comeback. Ever since his friend Marvin Gaye had released the game-changing What's Going On in 1971, Robinson had wondered whether he could ever make his own self-produced concept album. What's Going On was, in Robinson's own words, the greatest album ever made by anyone, a sacred work that effortlessly flowed from theme to theme, one song melting into another. Could he do that himself? As he drove home from the Motown offices, he started to Freeform. Well, I said, I've always been a quiet singer, but now I'm going to go back and take show business by storm. That would be some quiet storm. Robinson laughs at the comic simplicity of it all. That's a great idea, I thought, so I went home and I started to write it. Quiet Storm, the song, would channel those Santa Ana winds echoed in the final recording by the flurry flute of Fred Smith. It would have a mood of newly restless, erotic turmoil, a power source of tender force, generating, radiating, turning me on, and a nighttime feel influenced by the jazz vocal records of the 1950s. And here's a little bit of that song, Quiet Storm, by Smokey Robinson.
Soft and warm, a quiet storm, quiet as when flowers talk at break of dawn, break of dawn. A power source of tender force, generating, radiating, turn me on, turn me on. Circuit all my nerves, promising electric things. You touch me and suddenly there's rainbow rings. Quiet storm blowing through my life. Oh, quiet storm.
I thought with my comeback, I'm going to be on more of an adult train, says Robinson. The Miracles were a teenage pop group for young people, but our fans were growing up with us too, getting older. So I felt like this is how I change my image. Robinson was aided in this goal by his sister, Rose Ella, who helped co-write the title track and the up-tempo, almost disco groove of Love Letters, about imaginary messages of passion never sent. I grew up in a home where there was nothing but music, explains Robinson. My mom played gospel and blues and classical, and my two sisters were playing jazz. My sister, Rose Ella, was also a great lyricist. I used a lot of her songs in my life. Her background was basically Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Sarah Vaughan, Billy Eckstein, Patti Page, and Frank Sinatra. So she had that kind of flavoring in her writing. I took the Quiet Storm song to her and asked her to finish it because I wanted that feel, like a capital recording artist singing from the Great American Songbook, a languid intimacy. That was my intention, absolutely. Like a lot of pop stars, Robinson is reluctant to discuss albums and singles that weren't hits, so he's a little taken back when Mojo asks about another possible influence on A Quiet Storm, an album he recorded with the Miracles in 1970 entitled What Love Has Joined Together. A concept album consisting mostly of covers of Motown love songs. My Cherie Amour, You've Made Me So Very Happy, If This World Were Mine, plus The Beatles' And I Love Her, Bacharach and David's This Guy's In Love With You, and Robinson's own What Love Has Joined Together. It was originally performed as a medley on NBC's The Andy Williams Show in 1970. When re-recorded in the studio, it ended up as a miniature suite of seamless jazz soul, possessed of the same mood of drifting, enraptured euphoria as a quiet storm. "That's jazz again," says Robinson with a smile. "You're right. That was the Miracles and our arranger, Jerry Long, trying out that Sinatra jazz thing. Yeah, that's a beautiful album to me." The benign tenderness of What Love Has Joined Together returns on A Quiet Storm in the lazy, romantic wedding song, which Robinson wrote for the union of Jermaine Jackson and Hazel Gordy in 1973. It's also present in the street-smart Latin soul of Baby, That's Back At Ya, which would prove Robinson's first number one single since leaving the Miracles. "That song came about because I was thinking about someone loving somebody and not being sure whether or not that person is loving them back," he explains. And here's a little bit of that song, Baby, That's Back At Ya, by Smokey Robinson.
Oh, baby, now.
Amidst that mood of back-and-forth romance, A Quiet Storm is also a troubled album. It's there in the title track and in the 7-minute piano-led Happy, a song about the arrival of love in the life of someone heartbroken that still feels weighted by an immovable melancholy. But it's especially there in the agony and the ecstasy, a heart sick ballad about a secret affair where the pleasure comes hand in hand with pain. Love like ours is never, ever free. You pay some agony for the ecstasy. In his 1989 autobiography, Inside My Life, written with David Riz, Robinson talks explicitly of the conflicts between his love for Claudette and an affair with a dancer on the Soul Train TV show called Mita. "She was there nearly every night when I recorded A Quiet Storm," writes Robinson. "She inspired me. I couldn't let go of her. She was the quiet storm I felt blowing through my life. I wrote about it," and then Robinson quotes at length from The Agony and the Ecstasy. But when Mojo asked Robinson to reflect in 2025 on how the affair fed into his career-changing album, his response is terse. "Well, it didn't feed into it, man," he says empathetically, "because when I first started to write A Quiet Storm, I didn't even know her. A door has been closed." When A Quiet Storm was released in 1975, it was into a world of black music that was determined by funk and disco. A Quiet Storm was neither. In fact, if Robinson thought that he was going for an adult sound, that's exactly the audience who picked up on the record, an older, more prosperous, middle-class black audience. One station reaching out to that demographic was WHUR 96.3 in Washington, D.C. One of its DJs was soft-spoken Melvin Lindsay, a Howard University journalism student who, along with fellow student Jack Schuler, started a temporary Sunday evening show in January 1976 that specialized in smooth, medium, and down-tempo soul from the 50s, 60s, and 70s. The show was a hit, and when station manager Kathy Hughes gave Lindsay and Schuler their own show, they dubbed it Quiet Storm. Intimate, elegant, laid back, in time, Quiet Storm evolved from a single show into an entire radio genre, a late-night groove that encompassed everyone from Teddy Pendergrass and Rolls-Royce to Bobby Bland and Nat King Cole. By the late 70s, artists, labels, and songwriters were creating tracks that specifically fit the Quiet Storm genre. And in 1979, Robinson recorded one of his own. Cruisin' was, in his own words, kicked back but slammin', mellow but ballsy, big and small, all at the same time. And here's a little bit of that song, Cruisin', by Smokey Robinson. A Quiet Storm gave people something, a feeling, musically, that they needed at the time, says Robinson. Melvin Lindsay made my song his theme song, and it just took off all over the country. There are so many Quiet Storm radio stations out here to this day. I'm very happy that it happened. However, in the process, everything between A Quiet Storm and Cruisin' died a quiet death, including one of the best solo albums of Robinson's career, 1976's mix of long funk soul grooves and mournful late-night ballads, Smokey's Family Robinson. But it wasn't the first time a Smokey smash had overshadowed what followed. Take The Tears of a Clown, says Robinson. After we released that, I recorded another song that I thought was wonderful, called I Don't Blame You at All. You love that song, right? Okay, it never had a chance. A chance, because when it came out in 1971, radio was still clinging to 1970's The Tears of a Clown. Same thing happened with Smokey's Family Robinson. People were clinging to A Quiet Storm. Mojo asked Robinson whether those kinds of setbacks hurt. He ponders the question for a moment. You know, I don't really think like that because my favorite thing to do is not record but perform. So when I go out to perform, I'm not thinking about the latest success or setback. I want to just give it all that I have. When people are singing the songs that we're singing and having a good time, that's my joy. Back in the day, after a show, people used to come to me and say, "Okay, Smoke, where's the party?" I'd just look at them and say, "I just had my party." Now, the party for me is I'm going back to my hotel room, watch some TV, and go to sleep. Expertly 60 years in the interview game, Smokey Robinson has found a way to promote his forthcoming UK tour. Fittingly, the move was mellow but ballsy, big and small, all at the same time. Mojo asked whether any special arrangements have been worked on for the performance of A Quiet Storm. Well, he says politely, we have been doing those numbers live for 50 years, and I have a wonderful arranger, Jim Pappas, who's been with me since Sonny Burke passed in 2022. We have a good road family, 17 people, handpicked, nobody's on drugs, and nobody's an asshole. As for set lists, the plan is the same one as ever, despite this being the 50th anniversary of A Quiet Storm. Well, we play what the people want to hear. Andrew, will we play old stuff? Yes. Will we play stuff from Gasms? We're going to play them all. Ah, yes, Gasms. Released independently in 2023, the album might be the most surprising of Robinson's career. A concept album about sex and pleasure that sonically resides somewhere between A Quiet Storm and Marvin Gaye's Midnight Love. With song titles such as I Fit In There, You Fill Me Up, and I Wanna Know Your Body. Gasms emerged quietly to a mixed reception, but peculiar title track aside, it's arguably his best LP since 1987's One Heartbeat, a drifting, sensuous act of erotic invocation. Well, thank you, says Robinson. We're just gonna play some stuff from it and hope people will be accepting of it. I know they know the tears of a clown, but I hope they're also aware of Gasms. And if they're not, we're going to make them aware of it. Robinson famously lost his way in the early 80s, following the death of his father and the discovery that his girlfriend Candy was pregnant. The singer started smoking rock cocaine joints, an addiction that lasted for 2.5 years. I was at death's door with that stuff, he says. I was 40 years old, and I was killing myself. But I drew from it. I speak at rehabs, churches, schools, and gang meetings now, and I tell people that at first it's just a game you're playing. You're having fun. Next thing you know, that fun has killed you. Ask how he stopped. Robinson explains that he wasn't cured, but healed. I didn't go to no doctor, he says. I went to church, and the lady preacher prayed for me, and I was healed. May 1986. I ain't done a drug since, but I don't totally regret it because when I go to speak to people in rehab, I don't have to speculate. I know exactly what you're going through. Mojo tells Robinson that that's a good note to end on, regrets and life lessons learned. He disagrees. We need to end on something up, he says. I love the UK. I've loved it ever since the first time I first visited, back in the day, with the Miracles. It's always been a good place for me. It's been a long time, but I'm ready. I'm ready to come back and see you guys. I miss you. So tell everyone we're going to have a great time and I'm looking forward to it. Can you do that? Done. Now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's The Story by Brandi Carlile. Release date 2007. Walking the depressingly clean sidewalks of Rutland, Vermont one evening, I take a moment to reflect on this desolate state. Compared to my home in New York, Vermont is the land where time stands still. It's a wasteland of cows, open areas, and roads that lead to towns with 4 houses and 1 street. I look to my right and see a bumper sticker pasted to a used bookshop window that reads, Vermont, where the party never ends because it never began. And I can't help but sardonically chuckle to myself, Nothing ever seems to happen here, I think to myself. And then I recall one shining moment in my history with this state when things were different. I was introduced to Brandi Carlile in a tiny Vermont theater with 1,000 screaming lesbians, 500 bearded hicks, and at least 25 mixes of the two. Dragged to the Paramount by my elder sister, I wasn't expecting much from this concert. Brandi was opening for the legendary Indigo Girls, who I personally despised, despite tons of familiar approval. Everything seemed set up for another slow-moving Vermont night, and I sulked into a state of typical angsty teenage apathy. But then the lights dimmed, and out walked a small but confident-looking brunette-haired woman with a denim jacket and a barefooted cello player. And without a word of introduction, she began finger-picking this sad little phrase on an old rundown guitar. I couldn't tell you the name of the song she was playing now, but I can tell you this. She was mesmerizing. Her voice was powerful, a stellar blend of hard knocks country female wisdom and a young woman's delicacy, and it echoed through the small Roosevelt-era theater with an opponent resonance. In spite of several years' worth of conditioned cynicism, I couldn't help but grin. The rest of her set was fantastic, a perfect mixture between toe-tapping crowd pleasers and heartwarming ballads, capped off by two astounding covers, a crowd interactive version of Johnny Cash's Folsom Prison Blues, and a truly faithful, chilling version of the Jeff Buckley Hallelujah. As she left the stage, to my surprise, I joined my family, the lesbians, the rednecks, and the question mark in a standing ovation, thoroughly entertained by a fantastic show. Thus, Carlisle's second album, The Story, is something of a minor disappointment to me. Though still driven by Carlisle's marvelous voice, The Story substitutes the stripped-down acoustic feel of Carlisle's live show with the trappings of mainstream pop rock, simple rock drumming, and harmonies out of the Wazo replaces gorgeous cellos and the sweet girl with guitar atmosphere Carlisle creates in person. Her lead single, The Story, has Carlisle singing, "All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am." With a fatigued quality over radio-friendly instrumentation, whereas live Carlisle drives the track with emotion as her backing band, twins Tim and Phil Hansmuth, lock in with their acoustic bass and guitar to subtly make the track intricate without taking the focus off Brandi. And here's a little bit of that song, The Story, by Brandi Carlisle.
All of these lines across my face tell you the story of who I am. So many stories of where I've been, and now I got to where I am. But these stories don't mean anything when you've got no one to tell them. I was made for you. I climbed a crow.
As the album comes to a close, a flash of that brilliance that made me love Brandi Carlisle returns for a brief, savory moment. Broken sticks and broken stones will turn to dust just like our bones, sings Carlisle over a sweet Irish cello, it appears. And for this song, I feel as though I'm back at the Paramount, discovering Brandi all over again. Again Today strips all the extra crap The Story throws on to Brandi Carlisle, and she sounds like a human again, not a radio staple. And here's some of that song again today by Brandi Carlile.
Bricks and broken stones are turned to dust just like our bones. It's words that hurt the most. Now isn't it? Are you sad inside? Are you home alone? If I could just pick up the phone, maybe you can see a better day, and you won't waste away under my watchful eye. Because I'm your hero and you're my weakness. Who's gonna break my fall when the spin starts, the colors bleed together?
If she just decides to swim and go all in and make what she's really capable of, look out for Brandi Carlile. Here's a little bit of another song off of that album by Brandi Carlile titled Cannonball.
I was born when I met you. Now I'm dying to forget you. And that is what I know. Though I dreamed I would fall like a wounded cannonball.
And unfortunately, once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the June 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. I'm going to start off with an article about a reissue of Nick Drake's The Making of Five Leaves Left. Then the 40th anniversary of Brothers in Arms by Dire Straits, and an interview with Peter Murphy of Bauhaus, and a classic album review of Lemonade by Beyoncé. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
Bright lights like wild lightning. Who shines?